You recall that yesterday I mentioned Dr. Budziszewski's ability to engage and to challenge a variety of audiences, and hopefully this was something you yourself became aware of and appreciated during his presentation. With that in mind, I would like to mention just another of his books called Written on the Heart, The Case for Natural Law. This was first published in 1997. It has some similarities with What We Can't Not Know, the other book I mentioned yesterday, but there are some different, each has a little bit of a different focus. With Written on the Heart, he actually engages extensively some of the different traditions of the natural law, Aristotle, Thomas, John Locke, and John Stuart Mill. And he presents them in particular with a view towards political philosophy, and so that would certainly correspond with what he's going to be speaking to us about this morning. And it's in general, it's an excellent introduction to the various natural law traditions. As he noted, besides the natural law, Dr. Budziszewski writes about conscience, moral character, family and sexuality, religion and public life, toleration and liberty. Other related publications include On the Meaning of Sex, which was recently published in 2012, and The Revenge of Conscience, Politics and the Fall of Man, which was recently revised in 2010. And again, more information about these and other publications and also his own professional life are at his website, undergroundthomist.org. Again, please join me in welcoming a professor of government and philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin, Dr. J. Budziszewski.
Good morning. Well, Lutherans are early risers. That was pretty hearty. At this time of morning, if I say good morning to my undergraduate students, they all just go. I'm very glad to see you here this morning. I should say one thing, just lest there be any misunderstanding in that very kind introduction. My book, Written on the Heart, was mentioned. John Stuart Mill's not a natural law thinker. I put him in the book, but as a challenger to the natural law tradition, he's on the other side. Okay, if you attended my other talk yesterday on the new paganism, you might find this one a little bit drier. More text, duller pictures, much more logical analysis. I'll be moving faster. The transition effects are not as fancy. I was a little bit surprised when I was asked to speak about this topic, frankly. It's not explicitly related to Christianity, although I think it is true. My topic is constitutionalism and the advent of Christianity into the world certainly had an effect on constitutionalism because it leavened our traditions of thought about political authority and political power and constitutional order. It leavened our traditions of thought by a conception of the dignity of the human person who is made in the image of God and who is not just material to be used as a tool of the state. However, if those things come up, it's not going to be primarily in the talk itself. You may introduce them during our Q&A. I'm just going to be talking straight about constitutionalism. But I hope you'll bear with me because the topic is important and it's certainly related to the conference topic, the state of the culture. Our constitutional order, at least so I hold, is dissolving. And I'm going to talk about not all of the reasons for that, but I am going to talk about one of the biggest reasons for that. What is constitutionalism anyway? My title is How a Constitution May Undermine Constitutionalism, which sounds a little bit paradoxical. Constitutionalism is the principle that the real authority of government, as distinct from its power, as distinct from its sheer ability to compel, this is a distinction that we don't often make, but we should, the distinction between authority and power, this depends not on the personality or will of the rulers, like Louis XIV there, but on prior principles of justice, on antecedent principles of right. Thus, what we commonly call the law, governmental enactments, is not the ultimate ground of justice. It isn't even the ultimate law. It is only an elaboration by human rulers, by human legislators, of these antecedent principles in the light of the circumstances at hand. To give a sort of a trivial example of this, well, let me make one more abstract point first. When the enactments that result from this elaboration by our human legislators meet certain conditions, you know, conditions like the fact that they have to be promulgated. There's no such thing as a secret law. You know, that they have to be made by competent public authority. I, as a private person, can't make a law, things like this. Then they, quote-unquote, bind the conscience of the citizens. That was the ancient term. It means they become real obligations. I am obligated in conscience to obey them. So my example, this is just a trivial one. The prior principles of justice obviously require that we take care for the safety of other people, for their well-being, that we not, for instance, drive recklessly on the road. That would be unjust, right? But these prior principles need to be elaborated. You could ensure, if you were a human legislator, you could ensure safety on the roads or contribute to that safety by requiring that everybody drive on the left. You could ensure or contribute to the safety on the roads by requiring that everybody drive on the right. Well, which way should you do it? Do these antecedent principles of justice determine that? No, of course. Either way would do. But we can't do both at once. So it's necessary for government to, the ancient term was, to specify or to determine the manner in which the principle was to be followed. So once the government enacts that we drive on the right, driving on the right becomes a real obligation, even though it was indifferent before. Now, the authority of the government, this is where I think many people get mixed up. They think that since the government can, by enactment, make something right that was not right before, like driving on the right instead of driving on the left, they think that means that the only ground of what is right and wrong is that the government says, and that whatever the government says is right or wrong. This is not true. The authority of the government to elaborate the prior principles of justice does not allow the government to violate those prior principles of justice. For example, no government could have the authority to command that we use those, I was talking about safety on the roads, to use automobiles as weapons to murder members of the opposition party. Power, then, is justified by authority. Authority is not justified by power. That's what it means when we have these ancient expressions like might does not make right. Power is justified by authority, not authority by power. This understanding of how it works simply is constitutionalism, with the one additional understanding that we have to work out suitable customs and understandings and modes of constitutional order to preserve that way of doing it. Now, you would think, then, what kind of custom? Well, how about the custom of having a written constitution? You would think, there's the thinker thinking it, you would think that a written constitution would provide constitutionalism with its highest and most perfect expression. How could you do better? You believe in constitutionalism. Well, write a constitution. That was certainly how the American founders expected their constitution to work, but as always with big ideas, what actually happened is a good deal more complicated. You know, you don't have to have a written constitution to believe in constitutionalism. Our cousins, the English, across the water, have a constitution. They speak of the English constitution, but they're not referring to a written document. They are referring to long-standing traditions of the mode of constitutional governance in England. No doubt, having a written constitution does promote the constitutional attitude in some respects. But something that was not anticipated when it became fashionable to write up constitutions, to set them on paper, something that was not anticipated in those days is that having a written constitution in some ways can undermine or discourage constitutionalism as well. Now, that's counterintuitive. It's unexpected. Surprisingly, some of the ways in which this can happen were anticipated by some of the critics at the time of the drafting of the U.S. Constitution. I think that the fact that there were serious critics of the enterprise in writing the U.S. Constitution is often swept under the rug now. it was only rediscovered, even as a topic of inquiry in American history in about the 1950s. The anti-federalists were the people who opposed the ratification of the U.S. Constitution, and they're not to be dismissed. You know, the country, for one thing, already had a constitution. It was under constitutional authority already, under what were called the Articles of Confederation, which have nothing to do with the Confederation of the Southern States and later something altogether different. But that was our first constitution. Now, the Continental Congress, it was very difficult to pass certain kinds of legislation under the Articles of Confederation, and it was very difficult to amend the Articles of Confederation. Their procedures for amendment were quite difficult. So when the Continental Congress decided we need a constitutional convention, the purpose of the convention was not supposed to be to write a new constitution. They said, we've got one. The purpose, rather, hold on, my microphone fell off my ear here. I'm too much a fidgeter. Am I properly being amplified still? Okay. The purpose of the new constitution was merely to streamline the drafting of amendments, the suggestion of amendments which might then be submitted to the Continental Congress and to the states. The Continental Congress explicitly instructed the delegates to the Constitutional Convention not to write a new constitution. What did they do? They tore up their instructions and wrote a new constitution. So it is not surprising that many Americans thought that this was an unconstitutional conspiracy, that it was an aristocratic faction that was trying to, an elite that was trying to seize power. They also had very specific criticisms of the constitution which was actually drafted. Now, I don't want to give a one-sided view. I have heroes on both the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist side. In other words, the side of the people who wanted to ratify the Constitution and the side of the people who didn't. But let's talk about one of the heroes on the Anti-Federalist side. This was a fellow named Brutus. It wasn't his real name. He was probably the New York State Judge Robert Yates. He had another pen name, too, which I can't remember at the moment. And he had anticipated some of the ways in which a constitution can backfire and actually undermine constitutionalism. He had been at the Constitutional Convention, but he wasn't happy with what happened there. Brutus didn't propose doing without a written constitution. What he proposed was drafting such a document differently, with a greater awareness of the ways in which such an instrument can backfire. His advice was not taken, and we're paying the price today. Now, the framers, those who got their way at the convention and who wrote the Constitution that they wrote and who succeeded in getting it ratified, the states did eventually agree, were more complacent. They didn't agree with the criticisms of people like Brutus. What was their strategy? Well, they agreed that governments are dangerous things. They're necessary. They're necessary for the common good. They're not evil. We don't say a necessary evil, but they are in principle a good thing, but risky. Risky. You have to keep them in control. In order to keep the federal government in control, the framers, such as James Madison, who wrote under the pen name Publius, along with John Jay and Alexander Hamilton, depended heavily on checks and balances, which the Anti-Federalists didn't altogether reject, but they had a different theory of how checks and balances worked. Now, it's important to keep in mind what relying on checks and balances really means, because we really often misunderstand this today. What it really means is that they neither expected nor desired that the legislature, the executive, and the judiciary would get along. People often today say, oh, if only we would just hang together like the founders of the Republic did and try to make common cause and all get along. That would be so much better if only the president and the judiciary and the legislature wouldn't fight with each other, if only the parties wouldn't fight. The framers would say, what are you talking about? You wish they wouldn't fight. We want them to fight. That's how the whole system stays under control. They expected them to struggle against each other for power because they thought, as Alexander Hamilton brutally put it, men love power. And they thought that rather than futilely fighting against that, what you could do is use the fact. The legislature would try to steal power from the executive and judiciary. The executive would try to steal power from the legislature and the judiciary. The judiciary would try to steal power from the executive and the legislature, and they thought that that would be just fine. Why? Why just fine? Why not bad? Why not wicked? Why not evil? You may be thinking, who will guard the guardians? But the guardians are guarding each other, unlike the situation we have there. If each branch tried to steal power from the others, what would keep them in control? What would keep one branch? What would keep, for instance, the president from swallowing up the power of the other two branches, or the legislature from swallowing up the power of the other two branches? That's what was happening in some of the states. The legislatures were becoming the rulers of the show. They were shoving the governors and the executive branch out of the way. What would keep them, what one branch from taking over all the power, assuming to itself all three kinds of power, and ruling as a tyrant? Would they be kept in line by sheer constitutional prohibitions, where you'd put in your document, don't do that, don't do that, thou shalt not do this, okay, thou shalt not rule by executive decree, thou shalt not do such and such? No, Madison mocked such prohibitions. He called them parchment barriers. Actually, his solution and the solution of the other framers was different. The way they envisioned checks and balances working was that the three branches then would keep each other in control. This would work because the Constitution would keep each branch weapons of self-defense against the others. Yes, each branch would be greedily trying to swallow up the power of the others, but each branch would also be equipped with powers of self-defense that it would use because it was motivated to use because it greedily wanted to keep its powers and didn't want the other branches to swallow it up. These weapons of self-defense are all that checks and balances are. They are nothing more than weapons of self-defense that are given to each branch against the other branches. They are, in the slang of our own day, they're equalizers. You know, you've got these macho tough guy movies and a guy who swings a gun around and he says it's his equalizer. Well, something like a presidential veto is an equalizer. You see, a president might say, you, Congress, are trying to do something unconstitutional. You have passed a law that is an exercise of a power you don't even have constitutionally. And it is encroaching on my constitutional territory. So I will stop you by wielding my equalizer, my veto. And then Congress might say, no, that is not, in fact, the way that it is. You are the one who is encroaching on our power in trying to stop us from exercising our constitutional powers here, and we will use our equalizer. We will override your veto. Now, here is the problem. This is depending on dynamic equilibrium among three jealous powers to keep the whole thing balanced. That's a pretty delicate and dicey operation. You have to really know what you're doing. And if you're going to hand out weapons of self-defense to equalize the three branches, you need to know how strong each one is to begin with. You don't want one branch to be like that tough guy in the image there, you know, screaming at the other branch that's saying, leave me alone, leave me alone. The weakest branch, therefore, the framers reasoned, needs the strongest powers of self-defense. And the strongest branch, the one that has the greatest natural advantages, just in the nature of things, needs the weakest powers of self-defense, right? If you're trying to equalize a 98-pound weakling and a great big linebacker, well, the linebacker needs some power of self-defense because the 98-pound weakling might club him over the head while he's sleeping. But he doesn't need the same powers of self-defense as the 98-pound weakling does because he's so much bigger and stronger. So the question arises, before you begin designing your system of checks and balances, which branch do you expect, just in the nature of things, will be stronger? And if you get that wrong, then your system of checks and balances is going to be all askew. Now, the framers believed that the legislature would be the strongest branch. Because since the people elected the legislature as their representatives, they would trust them. They expected the people would, I mean, they were not expecting what we see today, where people put, they survey people and they say, who do you trust more, a dentist, a used car salesman, your elected representative? You know, elected representatives are way, way on the bottom of the list. these days, and people are always angry at Congress. But the framers were expecting that people would think of that they'd be full of the pride of self-government, of Republican liberty, and look upon the legislature as expressing the voice of the people, and they'd say, those are our guys. And that that would give the legislature a natural advantage, quite apart from what you designed as checks and balances, a natural advantage which the executive and the judiciary wouldn't have, and which you'd somehow have to equalize by giving them stronger checks. Do you see? That why did they think the judiciary would be weakest? Well, it would have neither what they called the power of the purse, in other words, the budgetary power, which Congress, especially the House of Representatives, has, and it would not have the power of the sword, that is the enforcement power, which is what the executive branch has. It would only have, it would only have, they said, the power of judgment, of expressing a judgment. And in order to get other people to go along with that judgment, apart from sheer reasonable persuasion, well, they'd just have to have the willing cooperation of the other two branches or they'd be ignored. Now, if the purpose of checks and balances is to equalize the branches, then if this is what you expect, you've got to give the weakest powers of self-defense to the legislature. And you've got to give the strongest powers of self-defense to the judiciary. You don't need to arm the legislature against the executive and the judiciary because it's already armed. But you have to arm them against it. Brutus thought this was exactly the wrong thing to do because he said, and he was writing largely from his experience as a judge himself and also as a scholar of the law and a scholar of the history of the law, he thought this was exactly the wrong thing to do because he said it is not the legislature that has the natural advantages. It is not the legislature that is going to be the strongest. It is going to be the judiciary. He had a lot of things that were very interesting to say about this. He said because of the recent history of England, we often think that the great power is going to come from, the great danger is going to come from perhaps the executive or something like that, and that from recent experience in the states, we may think, well, the legislatures will be, you know, kind of wild and woolly, but judges are such temperate and responsible people, and they'll be champions of liberty. And he said, but over time, what you will find is that legislatures settle down. They aren't so wild and woolly. Whereas, by contrast, judges are going to consolidate their power and become increasingly severe and increasingly arbitrary. Now, why did he think that that would happen? If he was right, then the constitutional design had an enormous flaw, because you didn't have sufficient checks against the judiciary. But why did he think the judiciary would be strongest? He thought the judiciary would be strongest because the Constitution, the chief reason is that the Constitution is a kind of law. It is a kind of law, and the Constitution says the courts, and in particular the Supreme Court, is the supreme tribunal in settling cases under the law and under the Constitution. You know, if the Constitution is a kind of a law, and if the Constitution makes the judiciary the supreme authority in settling cases that arise under the law, then it would seem to be reasonable to infer that the judges get to interpret the Constitution. So he was afraid that whatever judges said the Constitution meant would stick. Now, does the Constitution actually say whatever judges say the Constitution means should stick? It does not say that. But he predicted that that was what was going to happen, and it did happen quite early. Now, you may be thinking, well, hold on. You know, I've been taught ever since fifth grade, you know. The executive is to enforce the laws, and the legislature is to make the laws, and the judges are to interpret, you know, the Constitution and the laws. Isn't the judiciary supposed to monopolize constitutional interpretation? What our textbooks is giving here is not actually the view even of the framers, much less the anti-federalists, but it's giving us the view of those who won this constitutional battle. You know, it's giving us the view of the victors in that if you really want An older view is this. If you really want checks and balances to be an equalizer, to equalize the three branches, then among other things, you're going to want the three branches to have equal power to say what the Constitution means. This was, by the way, Abraham Lincoln's view. He thought, for instance, in the Supreme Court case Dred Scott versus Sanford, should the slave be, who had gotten to free territory be returned to his former master, the Supreme Court says, well, yes, he has to be. What Lincoln said was this: the Supreme Court has the authority to adjudicate the case, and therefore I will send Dred Scott back. I don't have the power to settle the case. The Supreme Court has the power to settle the case. The Supreme Court, of course, has to work out its own interpretation of the Constitution in order to decide how the case should be settled, but I don't have to agree with the court's interpretation of the Constitution, and I don't. And in my own executive decisions and my own legislative proposals and advocacy of limitation of the expansion of slavery and so forth, I am going to proceed on a different interpretation of the Constitution. So you see, the idea then is that the legislature would say what the Constitution means in the context of making laws. The executive would say what it means in the context of carrying out the laws. And the judiciary would say what it means only in the context of adjudicating cases. That was more the original idea. In other words, then, in a system of co-equal branches, just because the judiciary says the Constitution means X, it doesn't follow that the other two branches have to roll over and play dead. If they think the judiciary is wrong, then they can use their checks and balances to oppose it. Now, there are some checks against the judiciary in the Constitution. There are, so to speak, Article 3 powers whereby Congress can actually form new courts to remove certain categories of cases from the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, and it can do all kinds of things. These things are very rarely done. Most people don't even know about those possible checks against the judiciary because they're so rarely used. That's very interesting. Why aren't they more used? Brutus wouldn't be surprised. He didn't think that they were going to be used. He thinks that the other branches ought to check the judiciary when it does wrong, but he didn't expect them to do it. Why not? Why didn't he? Because the framers had made a huge mistake in assuming that the branches would always be in competition with each other for power. Remember, their theory of checks and balances is each branch wants power. Each branch is eyeing the power of the others and wants it for itself. Each branch wants to keep the other branches from getting its power, like a dog with a bone. You know, I want your bone. You better not take my bone. Grrr. They assume that's how checks and balances, that would be the motor that drove the use of checks and balances and that would keep the whole Constitution in equilibrium. They assumed that if any branch, like the judiciary, tried to grab power, then the other branches would be jealous and resist. But Brutus says, this is mistaken. What Brutus argues is that often Congress will be perfectly happy to let judges tell it what the Constitution means and what they can do. And they'll roll over and play dead. One reason is that legislatures are easy to get rid of. They have to face re-election. But judges are hard to get rid of. You know, we sometimes say inaccurately that they hold office for life. That's not true. You can convict them in a trial of impeachment, but it's rather difficult to do. They hold office during good behavior, as the expression is, and it's hard to prove bad behavior and get rid of them. So why should that matter? Because legislators have a fixed term, and if they want to be reelected, they have to face the voters again. Concerning some hot issues, then, they might prefer to pass the buck to the courts. You know, I don't want to have to make a decision on this hot issue. The voters will be mad at me. I won't get reelected. So the courts won't mind because they don't have to face the voters. And they like throwing their weight around. That was what Brutus expected that they would like. Another reason that Brutus thinks Congress will go along when the courts tell it this is what the Constitution means, just listen to us, is that the courts may actually help Congress to gain power. Now you think, well, wait a minute. If this is a zero-sum game, as the game theorists put it, if this is a pie, and if each branch, by getting more pie for itself, causes less pie to be left over for the others, then how could one branch help another branch to gain power? How could they both gain it once? This is how it works, and it throws the logic of checks and balances into a cocked hat. The framers of the Constitution just were not anticipating this. James Madison was thinking that there was only one pie, you see? It's the pie, and it's divided into three pieces. There's the legislative, the executive, and the judicial part. So if that were true, then yes. If one branch gets a bigger piece of pie, the other branches have to settle for a smaller piece of pie. But Brutus thinks, no, federal power is one big pie, but there's another pie too. State power. And all three of the federal branches can enjoy more power all at the same time if what they've got is a big scoop and they're scooping out some pie from the state pie plate and putting into the federal pie plate. And that's something that the judiciary can help the legislature to pull off. So that rather than checks and balances being used because the judiciary and the legislature are in competition with each other for power, what's happening is that the judiciary and the legislature may be in collusion with each other to expand both of their power at the same time, but at the expense of the states. Congress is losing something because it's allowing judges to monopolize the power to say what the Constitution means, but Congress doesn't mind because it's gaining much more because the same judges are scooping out filling from the state pie pan into the federal pie pan, and there are more decisions that the states no longer get to make, but the feds in Congress do. So instead of competing with the judiciary, the legislature colludes with the judiciary against the states. Is that pretty clear? Good. Now, still another reason that Brutus thinks courts will get away with murder is that they can use or they can invent what are called legal fictions. A legal fiction is a falsehood. Everybody knows that it's a falsehood. Nobody thinks it's true. But it is deliberately accepted by the courts as true just in order to get away with something that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do. Brutus points out that the courts have often used legal fictions to expand their own powers. There was an example in England. There was a court. This was talked about by Sir William Blackstone in his famous commentaries on the laws of England, which just about every American of the day who was educated had, you know, read. In England, the Court of the Exchequer, interesting court, it was intended for lawsuits by people who owed money to the crown and who would go into court to say, I can't pay it back, let me off the hook, because the actions of third parties have made me less able to pay my debts, and it wasn't my fault. So in order to have your cause heard in the Court of Exchequer, you had to say words to the effect, I am a debtor of the crown. Okay? I don't know what the form of words was, but it was words to that effect. Now, eventually, though, the Court of Exchequer lost interest in whether the people who came before it really we'd like to be able to decide more different causes that come before us and controversies. So we'll let people file suit in our courts, even if they aren't debtors of the crown. All they have to do is say they are, and we'll let it pass unchallenged. And that is exactly what happened. Somebody would come into court and say, I'm a debtor of the crown. He wasn't a debtor of the crown. The court knew perfectly well he wasn't a debtor of the crown, but they let it stand. Complainants merely had to say they were, and the court would hear their suits. So the court, you see, had used a legal fiction to expand its jurisdiction to make itself more important. Another example of that is the Court of King's Bench, this had to do, I know I remember less about this, it had to do with complaints because of violence by other parties. There was one case where somebody wanted to complain because, a famous case, he wanted to complain because he'd been sold wine that had been adulterated. Okay? It was wine mixed with water or something. So he said that by force and blows it had been adulterated. You know, which made it sound as though violence had been used, and therefore he could be heard in this particular court, which otherwise he wouldn't be able to have been heard in. And the court says, yeah, that's okay, because we'd like to hear this case. Now, Brutus says he thinks that courts will use legal fictions to expand their own jurisdiction to settle more things that aren't any of their business to settle here, too, here in the United States, too. The bizarre lengths to which legal fictions can be taken is suggested by the view of the former Supreme Court Justice, he's been dead for a couple of decades now, William Douglas, who argued in a 1970s case in a dissenting opinion. It was an environmental case, Sierra Club versus Morton. He said that he and his fellow judges ought to allow what he called environmental objects to sue in federal court, that the federal doctrine of standing should be modified so that they had standing to sue, just as though they were human beings. Do you know what that means? A pond could bring suit in court, claiming that it was being polluted. A mineral deposit could sue, claiming that it was being depleted. Now, what that really means, of course, since the mineral deposit cannot speak for itself, is that somebody claims to be speaking for the mineral deposit and brings suit on its behalf. Do you see? But this is a way of transferring jurisdiction over what shall be done about this. It's transferring jurisdiction over the formation of environmental policy from the legislature to the courts. That's the whole idea of it. Now, did Justice Douglas get his way? No, his was a minority opinion. I'm giving it only as an example of the kind of thing that could be done. But, you know, in our day, equally crazy legal fictions have been proposed. For example, I came across this one just about a week ago. Some animal rights activists have been proposing that U.S. courts follow the example of an Argentine court, which has allowed lawyers to file a writ of habeas corpus on behalf of an orangutan in a zoo. Okay, the orangutan was claiming that it was being unjustly detained. And the court ruled for the orangutan. You see, this, and the idea, of course, is to get policy about the treatment of animals taken away from the legislature and put into the courts. That's what's really happening. So you see what this is really about. It's about courts stealing the legislature's power of making laws and giving it to itself. Now, you might say, come on, that's all kind of hypothetical. These things haven't happened yet. We don't have to restrict ourselves to legal fictions that have been proposed but not adopted to see what this means. Let's think about some that have been adopted. I have shortened my list, and I'm leaving out all of the details and the citations, but just for a few examples, a fictitious history has been employed to conclude that the First Amendment requires neutrality between religion and irreligion. Okay? The First Amendment does not require neutrality between religion and irreligion. It clearly favors, it is clearly in favor of religion. That's why it guarantees its free exercise. As a matter of fact, in the very Supreme Court opinion that I have in mind, the court said, and a further reason for neutrality between religion and irreligion is that the founders showed by enacting the free exercise clause that they believed in the value of religion. Now, what? Premise. Religion is valuable. Conclusion, religion is no more valuable than irreligion. How does that follow? Okay, this is a legal fiction of sorts. There is a fictitious psychology that has been employed to maintain that the only possible motive for opposing special preferences for homosexuals is irrational resentment or animus. Now, that is plainly not true. There are all sorts of reasons having to do with the natural law, with public health, with all sorts of other things, you know, for upholding certain laws concerning this subject. But it's just a lie. It's a canard to say it's all because of animus. But it's a lie that is useful for bringing about the outcome that you want, and claiming that this now becomes a constitutional issue instead of something for the legislatures to decide. A fictitious embryology has been employed to insinuate that a child in the womb does not enjoy actual life, but only potential life, as in Roe versus Wade. It said, well, you know, up to a certain point, there's no life. There's only potential life. That's biological nonsense. From the moment of conception, you have a unique living human being here. Find me a doctor who says, that's dead. It's not alive yet. No, you can't find it. A fictitious classification has been employed to characterize the destruction of unborn children as reproductive behavior. You will find that the court classifies abortion, quote-unquote, rights as reproductive rights. What? How is killing a child an act of reproduction? This is clearly an anti-reproductive right. It's, in fact, an anti-life right. These are just a few cases of outrageous legal fictions. The use of fictitious suppositions has become such a pervasive feature of constitutional interpretation that I think that we should probably no longer speak of simply jurisprudence, of actual jurisprudence. We should speak of virtual jurisprudence. You know, it's like virtual reality. Virtual jurisprudence is particularly dangerous because in the name of the Constitution, judges now routinely discard the moral and philosophical basis of the Constitution and of the laws and put an entirely different morality and philosophy in their place. A philosophy often, I might add, of radical self-sovereignty. And it is truly startling. It's all about you is the philosophy. The purest expression of this philosophy is found in a confession of faith. It is a confession of faith. It's a creedal statement, which has come to be known as the mystery passage. The mystery passage. It is in the 1992 case, the opinion of the plurality in the 1992 case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey. This was what the plurality said. I quote, "At the heart of liberty," excuse me, "at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life." Let me repeat that. "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life." Now, you notice one of the tricks here is that you didn't look at the rights that are actually enumerated in the Constitution. What you're instead doing is claiming a certain philosophical basis for those rights and acting as though the Constitution enacted your philosophy. And what your philosophy holds is that you have a right to make up your own definitions of existence, meaning, the universe, and the mystery of human life. Now, you might think, well, that doesn't sound so bad. We do have a right to think what we want to think about those things, right? To reach conscientious decisions about what we believe in good faith and on rational reflection that they mean, and nobody can coerce my conscience and coerce my mind. The government can't lobotomize me or give me drugs or put me in jail because I believe the wrong thing. Yes, but this isn't about belief. This is about action. You see, what Planned Parenthood versus Casey was an abortion case. It was giving this right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life as a reason why you can commit abortion. Do you see? Do you see how the logic of it works? You get to define your concept of existence, so if you say, well, that child doesn't exist, you can snuff it out of existence. Now, if you follow out the logic of a premise like that, you come to conclusions that the court did not intend. The logic of the mystery passage logically implies liberty for anyone at all to take any life whatsoever. You know, I kill my next door neighbor. Well, you know, my concept of existence doesn't include your existence. I get to define my own concept of meaning. Your life has no meaning. I get to define my concept of the universe. According to my concept of the universe, you have no place in it. And according to my concept of the mystery of human life, you know, you don't have a life. Now, that would be logical, but of course, the court does not say that. The court does not draw the conclusion that you may kill anyone you want. It says you may kill only certain persons, you may take only certain innocent lives, those of unborn children. And it makes itself the one who decides which of these innocent lives you may take. This illustrates, though, how even the language of liberty can be used to usurp power. You would think, man, how could saying everybody has this liberty, this magnanimous liberty to define all of these things for themselves as though I am God, you know, how can that be an instrument of seizing power? Well, it is one here because, you see, universal liberties are never really universal. Universal permissions never, of course, can be carried out. You can't permit everybody to do everything. They are always cloaks for the transfer of power to say what may be done from one set of hands to another. Any king, and this is my concluding thought, who says everything is permitted will always add, but I decide for everyone what everything includes. Thank you.